Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. I have two of my favorite Meyer people in the chat room tonight, which is always a treat. Thanks for stopping by. This is something I've talked about many times before, and what amazes me about this Meyer material is that when you go over it, again, it's like layers of an onion that you're peeling back. You're finding information that you didn't see before and you don't know how you missed it. The other thing I think is, you know, over time, your consciousness evolves a little bit more. So you start to understand the significance of things and start to pay attention to how more of these details fit together. This is a experience that I believe Billy had back in 1953. He met his second extraterrestrial mentor, a woman named Asket. Now, Asket is a female from the Tao universe. The Tao universe is a parallel universe to ours. It was created 46 trillion years ago, at the time of our Big Bang. And the Meyer information later on in this contact, way later, describes that there are multiple universes which are adjacent to each other. So there's our, what's called the DERN universe, which is our universe, and then right adjacent to ours is this Tao universe. And there are other universes as well. And these universes are said to be in different time planes. The Meyer material often calls it different space-time configurations. The Tao universe is in a slightly different space-time configuration. Asket, who Billy is going to meet for the first time in this contact, her people are originally from our universe, but they at some point had the technology to travel into this other universe, lost that knowledge for a while. Doesn't really say how they lost it or whatever, but they rediscovered the ability to go back into this parallel universe. And I'm already starting out with the show on a great tangent. That's the way it happens sometimes. But the Timmers have the same forefathers as us, the Lyrians. And the same forefathers as the Plaiaren. The Timmers, at least one of their large ships, have come back from the Tao universe, and this is in 1953. And Asket is going to be Billy's second mentor for about 11 years and is going to teach him. The other reason the Timmers are here is because during this time frame of this 11 years on the Earth, there was the potential, a great, great potential, that we would absolutely destroy the Earth and affect our solar system and other systems in the process. So that's what the other problem that the Timmers were trying to mitigate was this, I guess, a nuclear holocaust. Asket explains that the people of the Earth have learned to use the foundation stones of life to create weapons. So they were here for these two reasons. One is for Billy being mentored, and second, to stop this great disaster from occurring. So this occurred on February 3rd of 1953, and Billy had walked up on this hill, and I assume he's still in Switzerland at this point, a hill that he had gone to the top of before. It's one of the places where he likes to contemplate things, where he likes to meditate things. And he had heard about 16 days earlier, Svath had told him that Asket would meet him here. And one of the things I remember reading through this again that I hadn't heard of before is that Billy remembers breaking out into this sweat, even though it was very, very cold outside. And once he got to the top of the hill, he didn't have to wait very long to see this thing coming out of the sky, a bright line that plunged down from the sky, and it sat down on the frozen hard ground there, which was not far away from him. It was a very bright light. It was a disc. He called it, he said, he described it as matte silver and discus shaped. And he said, once it landed, the bright light went out and it stood there very majestically, he said. Now, the interesting thing was that it had these, what he called, three landing spheres on it. And he had said, Billy had said that he had never ever seen a form of landing structure like that before. Next, it says he has a telepathic invitation. Now, this is interesting because I don't know where this telepathic invitation is coming from. Is it coming from Ascot, who's not in the ship, by the way? Is it the ship that is giving him this telepathic invitation? And he approached the ship, he says, as almost under a gentle compulsion. And the opening opened up in the ship, and he said he was brought into the ship as if by ghostly hands, because there was neither a lift nor some other sort of entrance possible. And he remembered when he was very young how that Spoth would bring him into his ship that way. Now, when Billy got on the ship, there was only one armchair present. There was no one else in the ship. So he decided to sit down on this ship. And when he sat down in the seat there, the only seat that was available, this enormous change occurred. And he said, and I'll read it to you here, it says, a change which in my life up to this point had always only appeared to me as a dream and fantasy. The bright light, which came from everywhere in the interior of the ship, suddenly went out. And then suddenly I seemed to be sitting outdoors. So what's happened is the ship has become invisible. He's in the ship. The ship is invisible, and it's flying. He starts to move upwards. So he's sitting there. He can't see a seat. He can't see a ship. He can't even see his own self anymore. And he starts to move upward and at an angle in the night sky. And he slowly floats at this low altitude over the nearby village. Imagine this. And he's just hanging there, 2 meters in the sky over the house which belonged to his parents. And then he hears Ascot's voice again. Suddenly, he says, and she gave him a several minutes long explanation in relation to what was going to happen in his life in the future and what was going to happen in relationship to his family life. Okay. So after the explanation, the ship starts to move again. Again, Billy sees no ship. He doesn't even see himself. It moves eastward with this incredible speed, shooting high into the night sky. And he said he felt no G pressure whatsoever. He said it felt like going up in a lift. And let me read this to you. It says, the ship shot up with me in just minutes, higher and ever higher. And then for the first time, I saw the stars shine like I had never, up to that point in my lifetime, seen them shine big, beautiful, glorious, wonderfully, more powerful than I had ever seen them shine before on the earth. And it was, without a doubt, I was in outer space, very high in the daytime, side above the earth, which I still only saw as a blue, white, greenish ball. But actually, he wasn't seeing a ball. What he saw was the Earth in a half-full state, like the moon. You know, when the moon is half-full. he saw the sun in space there as a gigantic disk. And he saw what was the Indian Ocean. And he could see this light moving over the earth. In other words, this is a truly fantastic picture. I guess the sun must be coming up in some ways. So the ship became visible again as it starts to move down again. It becomes visible and the craft lands. And he's standing on dry, hard ground. And he noticed that it's sand. And the craft opens, he steps outside, and he sees this nocturnal landscape. And he saw a rock, a very large boulder, which he stepped out and touched, and it was extremely warm. And he realizes suddenly that he's in Jordan. And he notices something bright in the sky that looks like a stone, and it's moving very quickly through the sky. And then it gets bigger and bigger, and it's as big as the moon. And it's plummeting downward at a terrific speed. And then suddenly it stops in the middle of the sky, and it just hangs there. And it slowly moves downward. And Billy describes this as looking like a feather coming down in the night sky. He said, let me read this to you here. It says, "For me, it was actually a spectacle which I will indeed never forget. The luminous and completely soundless object which lit up the entire surroundings as bright as day and floated down to then quietly remain on its landing space. I waited for minutes because now something further would indeed have to happen. Yet," he talks about the time going by and nothing happens. And he waits something like a half an hour. And then suddenly he sees from behind the ship a figure that walks around. And the ship dims. And the ship glowed again with light. And then like in a weak twilight. And then he sees the figure of Ascot approaching. Now, she looked familiar to him, and he didn't know why. In fact, he describes it as having painful feelings, because I had indeed missed her in my earthly existence until now. So this is the first time he's ever met her. He sees her, he feels pain, and he knows he misses her. Now, isn't this odd? Very strange. Something from a previous life for sure. Ascot's somewhat peculiar greeting ceremony. Let me read it here to you. Ascot's somewhat peculiar greeting ceremony struck me as strangely familiar and known, yet with the best of will, I was unable to find out why she seemed so familiar and known to me. With a later question regarding this, Ascot only smiled and explained that I should consider my other personalities in earlier lives before this current one. And then Billy goes on to explain that as hard as he tried, he couldn't remember any more details. And he describes her as wearing some very unusual kind of clothing. And he describes her as looking like a very modern angel. She wore a floor-length, very heavily pleated dress in a peculiar whitish-silver color, and she was belted at the hip. And he draws a few analogies to religious texts and why that someone that looked like this might get a description as an angel. So in any sense, he did get into her ship, and the ship zoomed high into the sky, and he sees the Mediterranean Sea. They're flying over the Mediterranean Sea, and that the ship crossed over the sea very quickly, and then it sank down to the earth, and he could see the gigantic pointed structures below, which were the Great Pyramids, very shadowy. and they plummeted down into Egypt, into the pyramids of Giza. And one of the things that was interesting that I missed, again, a lot of things that I've missed, that I've listened to this many times and even read it, but I missed so many things, was that the ship, I thought for some reason in my mind that they had landed at a distance from the Giza Plateau, but actually they landed right next to the Sphinx. Let me read this to you. It says, "And now the sinking became a gentle flowing down to the Great Pyramid, which I have very well in my memory from many pictures, the Pyramid of Giza. I recognized it by the gigantic animal human, which as a statue stood not far from the Great Pyramid. We sank exactly towards the animal human object, the Sphinx. And for the first time in my life, I saw the Sphinx in its enormous natural state, because I had never before, at least not within my current lifetime, seen this. We sat gently down on the ground only a few meters from the gigantic construction, only a few meters from a small Bedouin camp, with various humans dressed like Arabs were already busy with the breaking of their camp at this early hour. Now, one thing that is strange is that Askit, when Billy and Askit, they leave the ship, they go outside, and she puts a device on Billy's belt, which makes him invisible, as well as making her invisible. Now, this is strange because their craft is invisible. It's sitting close to the Sphinx. Now, I would think that, you know, someone might run into it, or who knows, you know. I mean, how could they get away with all that? I think there's more going on here than we realize, or than we're told. And even if they're invisible, if they're walking along through the sand, can't people see their footprints? So maybe there's something else going on here. I'm not sure. But in any case, Billy plays a few tricks. There's some local women there, and he goes into a tent, and he kisses some of these women, and one of them faints, and they're all kind of amazed. They think they've been kissed by an angel, but it's just Billy playing around. So in any case, Askit and Billy continue their trip towards the Great Pyramid. And it says here, "Suddenly Askit grabbed me by the hand and led me to a small entrance opening to the pyramid. Through long, musty passageways, we walked in twilight through the interior of the pyramid. Then it was so dark, I could not recognize anything anymore. I wondered about the fact that I did not collide with anything, and that Askit found the way in spite of this literally Egyptian darkness." Evidently, there's a German idiom called Egyptian darkness, which corresponds to pitch dark in the English. So they keep climbing downward, 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 and then suddenly they see a very weak light off in the distance. And they keep moving, and then they see this gigantic stone, this squared stone, somewhere deep in the pyramid as a part of a wall. So the passageways goes right to a gigantic rock. And then right before his eyes, this gigantic rock simply dissolves into nothingness. And Askit pulled him through the opening quickly, and then the rock reforms suddenly, and they start going down a steeply descending passageway. And they keep in mind they're invisible. They see two oddly clothed men that are guards. And they kept going down, and then Askit telepathically warns him don't say anything, don't make any noise, because we're in a very dangerous place here. How does she say? She says, the guards we saw are members of or related to a power-conscious extraterrestrial group who, through certain impure means, force a majority of Earth humanity under their control in order to bring the entire Earth under their control. So they continue down the large hallway. And Billy eventually sees, as he's walking on these steps that lead steeply and deeply into the pyramid, deeper and deeper they go, until suddenly they stood in this gigantic hallway, which seemed to overflow with light coming from everywhere and nowhere. And this is where he sees the gigantic disc-shaped spaceship of the Giza Intelligences, which this gigantic spaceship is underground. Don't ask me how they got it there. And there are other discs, smaller discs, all around. Now, he said that he had seen a ship similar to this in 1942, but he didn't go into any more detail. Anyway, let me read this section here. He said, and this ship here must indeed have already been in this giant storage hall for centuries, or even for millennia, very deep under the earth, and by my reckoning, at least 3,000 to 4,000 meters below, and to the side and downward from the Great Pyramid. So he's standing there and he's contemplating this ship, and he's stunned. And then there's a plateau they describe, where he had to kind of walk over a little bit over to this plateau. And then he looks and he sees on the small plateau an ancient, large, and very heavily wooden Y-shaped cross. And there were three rusty nails next to the cross, which indeed hundreds or thousands of years ago must have been hand-forged nails, they're said. And then he notices that there's a brownish coating over the nails. And he wonders, are they blood-encrusted nails? And is he seeing the cross? I guess he is, indeed. And then he also sees an ancient wreath wound around many times with abnormally big thorns on which the red-brown coating was recognizable. And he saw what he said about a 2-meter blackish wooden rod, a purple-colored cape, and a small leather pouch with glass pearls or glass stones that appear to have rolled out. Now, Meyer Material says these are Emmanuel's crucifixion utensils, who they say is the true name of the alias Jesus Christ. And these in the pouch were precious stones, they said. And that must, I'm not sure exactly if that has to do with the what Judas was paid or whatever. Anyway, it says here, and I'll read it to you. Mute and moved, I stood before these witnesses of an ancient time which had been of worldwide significance for a very large part of humanity. Mute and moved, I stood at the things laying there and sent a grateful, quick prayer to heaven that I, of all people, was permitted to see everything here. And then he remembers the words of Svoth, who Svoth says the Christian religion is an irresponsible, evil, poor piece of work for the stupefaction and enslavement of humans. And this is where the Meyer Material, of course, gets very controversial. And they continue. Svas says a few, or Billy remembers a few of Svas' words again. And Billy remembers what Svas said about creation and Emmanuel. So Billy was very, very shocked and moved by all of this. And Askett registered Billy's thought dilemma. And now let me read this to you. It says, Askett must have fully registered my thought dilemma because she gripped me by the arm and pulled me along with her. The same way back that we had come shortly before, where I could still observe some things. So they climb this long way back to the surface, and he sees the Sphinx, and he sees their ship, which is invisible to everyone else. And they get into the ship, and they shoot highward at a very incredible speed. And it says here, the sun was already very high in the sky, and thereby I noticed something unbelievable. I had not been in the pyramids for only a short time, rather many long hours, although to me the time appeared only like minutes. The ship with Askett and me raced back with unimaginable speed and sat down on the same place from where it had started the flight to the pyramids, deep in the desert mountains of the Jordanian countryside. And the ship lay there more than 2 full days while Askett instructed me in very many things and also provided me with many explanations. It was for me 2 days of wonder, joy, recognition, and learning, and the acceptance of a mission. Now, what I've just gone over is called Askett's acquaintanceship. And to me, it's one of the most interesting contact reports that Billy talks about. And then that was his first meeting with Askett. Now, he would continue to meet with her for 11 years. And she would continue to be his teacher for the next 11 years. Now, Billy has talked to Ptah about the Great Pyramids and the pyramids in general on Earth before. Ptah is the leader of the Pleiaren in many ways. He's what's called an Ishwish. He's the king of wisdom. He is in charge of their mothership. And Billy asked Ptah about the pyramids, and he says, I would like to ask you something about the pyramids, which are not only found in Egypt, but all over the globe. And Billy says here, Askett told me once during a contact that the pyramids were constructed under the direction of extraterrestrials. At the time, in 1956, she stated that the pyramids were built 2 times, 36,650 years prior to 1956, and then 73,300 years prior to 1956, I guess. And, 40, 50, 60 years have passed since then. And Ptah goes on to say, in fact, that these pyramids were built 73,000 years ago, that not only the pyramids in Egypt were built 73,000 years ago, but in other places of the world. And he describes that everything about the pyramid has significant things about it. The height of the pyramid, which is 500 feet in height, represents 1 meter per million kilometers of the Earth to Sun distance. And Ptah explains that over the course of millennia, the outer limestone layers were removed due to erosion, or people removed them. And in different times, the pyramids were used for different things. And There was one time that I do remember somewhere, and it's, I don't have it right in front of me in my notes, but there was something called the Destroyer Comet, which used to come through our system about every 560, 570 years, something like that, on a regular passage. And this comet is bigger than any other comet that our scientists know about. Our scientists would say it's completely impossible to have a comet this large. But this comet was 1.7 times larger than the Earth. It was almost twice as large as the Earth. And when it would come through, it would wreak havoc on the Earth. This tremendous gravity would wreak havoc on the Earth. This comet actually came from a different space-time plane. You know, I was talking about space-time configurations before. But there was something that either the Lyrians or the Pleiarian did in many, many years back, that it was kind of a mistake they did, that allowed this object to travel from their space-time configuration into ours. And anyway, it used to come past the Earth on a regular cycle. I think this is why we have this thing ingrained with us about Nibiru or Planet X. I think it's really just the Destroyer Comet, which used to come through. And anyway, there was a king who had a son, a prince, who was a great remote viewer. And he could see in 300 years that this great Destroyer Comet was coming again. So they went into the Great Pyramid, far underground, and they used the limestone to kind of make the Great Pyramid airtight, watertight, and then they sat out this great passage of the Destroyer Comet again. And that's the way they survived this passage of the Destroyer Comet. And Billy goes on to talk about how that the pyramids were constructed under the direction of extraterrestrials, particularly humans from the Orion constellation. If you ever want to look for the Orion constellation, it's near the center of the Earth's equator. So if you look out, I mean, you could see it there. It has 8 stars. They're within 32 light years. The Orion star constellation is shaped in like a hunter, and that's the kind of the astronomy aspect of it. There the king I was telling you about, King Saluk, had a son named Sarad, who used the Great Pyramid as a refuge for this tremendous flood, which was brought on by the Destroyer Comet. This was 9,545 BC. Now, the Great Pyramid was also used as tombs about 2,000 years ago. In addition, the old cubicle construction far below the Giza Plateau have been used by these Giza intelligences for years. Until the late 1970s, the Giza intelligences were still around. And the Giza intelligences worked to control the people of the Earth, and they used all kinds of deception to try to control the people of the Earth. Now, I'm going to shift gears a little bit really quick. I know I'm talking about history, and I love this material. I think it's fascinating. But I want to step back to one of Billy's books that he's writing and has written within the last 20 years anyway. And This is a book, it's called The Way to Live. And it has various ideas and concepts that are very good for daily life. And I mentioned this a little bit on last night's show when I was talking to Daniel Cooper. And the principle here is that we need to learn to be our own best friend. And there are certain things about being your own best friend that you need to learn to do. Let me read this. Truly, whoever hangs around beyond his own house becomes the stranger in his own home and in his or her own family. Precisely, that happens when he or she constantly lives only in distraction, hangs around in discos, bars, hotels, and amusement parlors. He or she becomes a stranger to himself. Foreign in his reflecting and striving, foreign in his consciousness, foreign in all his thinking, feeling, and actions. Quite inevitably, such a human being must attempt to throttle his deadly inner boredom. And let me talk about this a little bit, because there's this principle. It's one of the laws of the universe. Now, the Meyer material talks about these creational natural laws. One of these is the law of striving. And it's something that you're constantly going to be coming up against. And we fight this battle of inner boredom sometimes. And the way you fight this battle is through striving. It's hard to do, and you're going to fight with this your whole life. You're going to be times when you just don't want to strive. You want to be lazy. But you'll find that there's no fulfillment in laziness. Okay, let me continue here. Quite inevitably, such a human being must attempt to throttle his deadly inner boredom in the pushing crowd of idle people, whereby he or she loses all self-esteem and the trust in him or herself. He or she totally forgets to observe and consider him or herself and to see him or herself as he or she actually is. He or she becomes a stranger to him or herself, whereby he or she falls prey to embarrassment. When through some circumstances he or she finds him or herself suddenly confronted with him or herself. Billy goes on to say here, unfortunately, there are too many human beings who seek out places, events, societies and circles, and so forth, where on one hand, they boastfully distinguish themselves. On the other hand, they are flattered to the point of drooling. Thereby, more than ever, a human being loses the very last taste for the voice of the truth. Not to mention that the last remnant of self-esteem and the last possibility of recognition of one's duty to oneself. And that's, I started out talking about our duty to ourselves. We have to be our own best friend. And when one's own duty disappears and sinks into a bottomless abyss, finally, it comes so far that the human being is concerned no longer with the voice of his or her own conscience. He won't listen to anymore. This conscience unpleasantly tells him the truth. So people in this state of being divorced from themselves, and I think that's where we are as a society. We're so detached from nature. We're so living within these cities that have made us disconnected from nature that we go and we seek out these places like, you know, the bars and the discotheque, which Billy's talking about. And he says here, he or she disregards his or her conscience and prefers to run far away from the inner and well-meaning voice of his or her conscience. And so his inner voice of his own conscience is shouted down by the roar and the tumult of those seeking enjoyment. You know, I wonder, and I said this on the show last night, I wonder if heavy metal music is a kind of reflection of the city itself. The sounds of machines and the screaming of the singers, it sounds much like the sounds of humanity in the city. I wonder, is heavy metal music an outlet for the urban suffering that the people are experiencing within the city? It's certainly a possibility. So Billy warns us, never neglect yourself and esteem your own friendship to yourself. Be caring, open, and honest towards your inner friend, to yourself and to your own eye. Constantly concern yourself with never turning your back on yourself, and thus never on your inner friend, whom you always need. Remain true to yourself, to your inner friend. So this is the inner eye that Billy talks about. You know, in many ways, you can almost think of the inner eye as your spirit form. You know, we do have a spirit form. It's located in an area of our middle brain called the superior colliculus. And the superior colliculus is the area associated with sight. The spirit form comes into the body of the child at 21 days. It energizes the whole body. It brings with it your new consciousness. Now, when you grow up again, you have to go through the painful process of learning to control your emotions again. Your material consciousness is not trained. It doesn't know how to talk. You have to learn how to talk again. But your spiritual consciousness is back there. It may have lived, you know, millions and millions of lifetimes, but the material consciousness is a child again. It has to grow back up. Now, as your material consciousness grows up again, it will receive impulses from your spirit. And that's why some children have quite a bit of an advantage over other children. It's because their spirit form is older. Now, Billy's spirit form, according to Playarn, is 9.6 billion years old. And they have the technology to track spirit forms. A spirit form must have something like a fingerprint. You know, each one has its own unique pattern associated with it, for lack of a better word. So the Playarn, they knew the Meyer spirit form was very ancient. They knew he was on here. They'd seen it incarnate before, where it had been Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. But they didn't realize how ancient it was. It wasn't until the later contacts that they actually realized that his spirit form had been in the person they called Nicodemus, which was their spiritual teacher, hundreds of thousands and millions of years ago. So they had a little bit of shock as well. It's a very strange thing, this Earth that we have reincarnated onto. According to the Meyer information, there have been civilizations on the Earth for hundreds of thousands of years. And I've talked about the Atlantis and Lemuria timeline before. 133,000 years ago, Atlant came here to the Earth, I think from the Barnard Star. About 113,000 years ago, a man named Eris came here, Eris the Barbarian. He came from Beta Centauri. He came here to stir up trouble. And we, at some point, we had the destruction of Atlantis and Lemuria. I still don't have the whole story, but I think about 11,500 years ago is when the great asteroid was slammed into the Earth, and basically it took many, many centuries for the Earth to recover from this. Finally, at some point, a group of extraterrestrials came to the Earth with not so good intentions. The man named Eris the 11th was here. He was the, what you might call the first of the Giza intelligences, although they were above the Earth at that time. He was murdered by his son, Jehovan, and Jehovan ruled the Earth until about 3,660 years ago. And Jehovan let himself be called the creator. You see, these extraterrestrials, they were kind of criminals. They were renegades. Jehovah ruled the earth till, again, about 3,660 years ago. He was murdered by his son Jehave about 340 years into his rule. Jehave was megalomaniacal like his father. He also called himself the creator, and eventually he was killed by his son, Erisame. So there was this long line. You know, finally when the earth was not a horrible, you know, these people came back. It probably sat, there was in a devastated state for many, many centuries. I think it was seven centuries until these extraterrestrials came back. And the people that were left, you know, after 700 years, they didn't, you know, they don't have any history. They're, you know, they're very primitive. They're groveling in the dust trying to grow something. And these extraterrestrials come here with all this technology. They don't know what to think. So Erisame was finally went into these old cubicle constructions, some that had not been inhabited for like for many thousands of years. He was the first official person in the Giza intelligences, Erisame. He ruled until about 3000 BC, and then Hen took over, who was also called Jehovah. And Jehovah is the same Jehovah in the Old Testament. He wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah. There were actually some nuclear weapons that were used during that. Jehovah was forced out by his nephew Comegal the First. That was in 2080 BC, and Comegal took over leadership of the Giza intelligences, and he was finally overthrown by Comegal the Second. The Giza intelligences were on the earth about until 1976. Now, in modern times, they were also here during World War II. The Giza intelligences, there was a man named Hermann Steinschneider who was part of the Thule Society, part of the Thule Society. He was directly influenced by these extraterrestrials, which were underneath the Giza Plateau. And Hermann Steinschneider influenced Adolf Hitler. Again, Adolf Hitler, he was a German politician, Chancellor of Germany from 1933 to 1945. He was the Führer of Nazi Germany from 34 to 45. He was a dictator. Now, unbelievably, he was destined to be a great man. The Pleiaren were actually impulsing him as a child. He was going to be a very, very positive influence on the earth. He would have brought the people of the earth together as no one else could have. If it wasn't for the Giza intelligences, he would have been one of the most famous, well-known, positive leaders of all time. But the Giza intelligences succeeded in taking possession of Adolf Hitler's being and misusing him for their dark and malicious purposes. These Giza intelligences, they deceived Earth humans with miracles and visions of every kind, and they were trying to maintain this religious delusion. Again, it was Hermann Steinschneider who had the tremendous influence over Adolf. In fact, Steinschneider became even more powerful in the course of time with respect to his domination over Adolf Hitler, which didn't appeal to a lot of people. A lot of people didn't like Steinschneider's influence on Hitler. And during his life, Hermann Steinschneider often went by the name Erich John Hannesson. In any case, he was supposed to be a hypnotist, a mentalist, an occultist, an astrologer. He talked too much, Steinschneider. He predicted the Reichstag fire. Eventually, he was killed because of some of the things he did. But anyway, these Giza intelligences were very negative people. They had very bad influences. For thousands of years, they're gone. But they're inevitably part of our history. In fact, in 1978, they attacked the Semyase Silver Star Center. The Plejaren had to put a shield around the building. Eventually, they were captured, arrested. They were deported. They were stripped of all their technology. They were incarcerated on a prison planet. However, according to Batah, the effects of their telenotic impulses will continue to linger for 200 to 300 years. Now, I wonder about this. I wonder if it is something that's genetically passed down. You know, that maybe hundreds of years ago, our forefathers were exposed to these hypnotic kinds of telenotic impulses, and the thinking process is passed down through the genes. I don't know. But again, they've used all kinds of religious delusion. They were looking for world domination. There were a couple people who had specific visionary experiences that were brought on by the Giza intelligence. One of them was Dan Fry, and the other one was Reinhold Schmidt. But again, they were just they were victims of these Giza intelligences who were using some kind of technology on them. Anyway, we did a pretty good history lesson tonight. A lot of the things I enjoy very much. Talking about Ascot, Billy's original trip to the Great Pyramid, where he was at least introduced to the Giza intelligences and what that was all about. This is one very incredibly well-written contact report. Things after this get a little stranger with the Ascot contacts. One of his, I think it's the next contact report, is where Billy goes back in time. He starts, they took one trip back to the 1300s, which is a very interesting discussion because they talk about things that made a kind of a big impression on me, like the tremendous freshness of the air. Billy described how the incredible, there was so much more oxygen on the earth in ancient times. We live in kind of a deprived oxygen. We don't realize it because it's all we know, you know, all we know. But that is one of the true things. And the other things that they talk about is the incredible amount of wildlife on the earth and the gigantic forests, which just went from one side of the planet to the other. And that actually, I think, was in the second contact report of of asking. Now, and I find, you know, part of the Meyer material you read and you, I don't know, it just doesn't, you know, I never go negative against it, but some of it is just like hard to wrap your mind around, you know. How, you know, really? Okay, they're traveling in time? You know, is this for real? It's just maybe sometime we'll go over that in a little more detail and talk about this in more detail. And then eventually Billy travels with Asket to meet Emmanuel, which is even more controversial. And that deals with the whole story of Emmanuel and also the history of the name of Jesus, which I like to go into. Let me read a little bit. Wow, I think we're running out of time here, but I want to read a little bit from Asket's explanations where they make their trip to 13th century France. He says here, "My head was full to the brim from all of Asket's explanations, so I followed her wordlessly to the ship and together with her let myself be carried into the ship by the invisible transportation powers. I lay awake for a long time on my comfortable couch and contemplated what I had heard. Everything seemed monstrous to me, and finally I had to forcibly tear myself loose from my raging thoughts in order to get any sleep at all. Still somewhat tired, I woke early in the morning. It was to me as if I had heard a shot somewhere. Asket also immediately got up from the couch and quickly approached me at one of the ship's windows. Some 200 meters, 20 meters away from the ship, stood a man who was leaning on his rifle. He grinned at us, quite obviously had fired a shot in order to cause us to notice him. It was without a doubt the man whom we met the other night, some days ago, far from the ship." Okay, this is the individual, Jitsi, who travels, again, allegedly with Asket and Billy, to back to the time of Emmanuel. And Jitsi is kind of symbolic, I think, of a real enthusiastic Christian person who kind of gets his whole world turned upside down. In any case, I've really enjoyed bringing the show to you tonight. I'll be back Monday, believe it or not, with a fellow named Jack Morfians, who has some really interesting insights into what's going on in the world and in the country right now. Anyway, have a great evening, and I appreciate everyone that stopped by the show. Good night.